Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Wireless World, Global Histories of International Radio Broadcasting by Simon J. Potter, David Clayton, Friederike Kein-Kovacs, Vincent Kaitenbrauer, Nelson Ribeiro, Rebecca Scales, and Andrea Stanton. Narrated by Alex Windham. Preface. This book deepens and revises our understanding of global histories of international broadcasting. It explores the idea of a wireless world, a globe connected, both in imagination and reality, by radio. It examines the extent and limitations of these transnational connections, how their nature and impact varied from place to place, and how they changed over time. It seeks to bring together more traditional accounts, which focus on states and broadcasting organizations and often take the form of institutional and international histories, with new approaches that draw inspiration from the history of technology, media history, cultural history, global and transnational history, and the study of soundscapes. The book has been co-written to allow coverage of a wide range of key themes and significant case studies. The authors have shared their expertise and access to original primary source material with one another. The chapters examine broadcasters and listeners in different countries and cover the entire 20th century, while also keeping an eye on the first two decades of the 21st century and on the future of international broadcasting. The book is the product of 5 years of collaboration. By working together, the authors have sought to transcend the conceptual, linguistic, and archival boundaries which have, perhaps paradoxically, rendered many previous histories of international broadcasting essentially national in focus. Each of the main chapters that follow draws on material from different countries and decades to address 7 key themes in the history of international broadcasting. Each main chapter is accompanied by 2 case studies, which are intended to widen the geographical and chronological scope of analysis still further. While much global history is often in effect the history of the Anglophone world writ large, this book seeks to offer a more encompassing approach to writing the history of our increasingly interconnected world, while recognizing that a great deal of foundational research is yet to be completed. SJP, Backwell, North Somerset, February 2022. 1. Out of the Ether: The Wireless World and the New Histories of International Radio Broadcasting. Simon J. Potter. For early distant listeners, picking up international broadcasts from far-off radio stations often seemed like an adventure, a courageous voyage to another land. In September 1928, J.D. Strange, writing as a yodeler, described how glowing accounts of the wonders which can be accomplished on the ultra-short waves had finally tempted him to succumb to the lure of shortwave work. Over the previous decade, radio broadcasting, or wireless as it was then generally called, had developed rapidly across Europe, North America, and other relatively prosperous parts of the world. In these places, radio stations and networks increasingly sought to appeal to local and national identities in order to attract an audience and to encourage listeners to feel a connection with the services that they provided. Yet from the very earliest days of broadcasting, transmissions had also crossed borders, promising to act as an international means of mass communication and forging connections among widely separated places and people. Wireless thus appealed not just to local and national identities, but also to a sense of cosmopolitanism. Wireless enthusiasts like Strange were, by 1928, already accustomed to tuning in faraway stations broadcasting on medium and long waves. Distant listeners took pride in picking up signals transmitted from other countries hundreds of miles away, and often attempted to bag as many stations as possible. They relished the technical challenge, and sometimes, if they could understand them, also enjoyed the programs that they picked up from stations in other countries. Medium and long-wave broadcasts could even cross oceans, and the most dedicated distance killers were willing to stay up into the early hours of the morning in their search for transatlantic signals. Yet medium and long-wave transmissions only traveled such exceptional distances when conditions approached perfection. Shortwave broadcasting offered a potentially more significant means for overcoming the tyranny of distance. During the 1920s, it became clear that shortwave radio signals could traverse the globe and be picked up thousands of miles away from the original point of transmission. However, the science of shortwave, the fact that signals bounced repeatedly between the Earth and the upper atmosphere, allowing them to travel vast distances, and the practical art of shortwave transmission and reception were still not fully understood. Listeners needed skill, patience, and special receiving equipment to tune in shortwave stations. Even if they possessed those things, mastery of this mysterious medium could still not be guaranteed. In describing his first attempts to seek out shortwave signals, Strange, an Englishman living in Switzerland, hence Yodeler, evoked both the sense of wonder that picking up stations broadcasting hundreds or thousands of miles away could create, and the challenges involved in attempting this feat. For a moment, nothing happened. Then came a Morse station, and I knew that the set must be functioning correctly. Carefully working the SM dial downwards, I suddenly paused. In the distance came the faint sound of music. Surely it was an English dance orchestra, and tuning in more carefully, I was just in time to hear, "By the BBC Dance Orchestra," in the old familiar tones, and I knew that I had arrived at the BBC's experimental shortwave station at Chelmsford. The transmission was coming through at splendid strength, and with the note magnifier connected up, worked the loudspeaker faintly. I was, of course, delighted with this immediate success, the only drawback at the moment being that every time I put my face too near the horizontal panel, the whole thing squealed vigorously. After carrying out an on-the-spot upgrade of his receiver to eliminate the unwanted noise, Strange embarked on a voyage of discovery in the shortwave sea. He tuned in a tremendously powerful station doing gramophone records. Slowly and clearly, the announcer intoned the call sign, "Hello, hello, PCJJ," and then stated in German, French, Dutch, English, and Spanish that he was calling from the Dutch shortwave station at Hilversum. Strange then picked up stations broadcasting from Berlin, Rome, Vienna, and Paris, all received at quite respectable strength. Subsequent listening sessions brought in Pittsburgh and Schenectady in the US, and then Melbourne, Australia. Although broadcasting from the other side of the world, the latter came in almost as loud as the British station at Chelmsford until very rapid fading began, and eventually it disappeared altogether. Strange's metaphor, a voyage of discovery on a shortwave sea, evoked an older way of thinking about radio, the idea of the ether. Since Newton, scientists had speculated that electromagnetic energy, including light and radio waves, was propagated through the ether, an undetectable, all-pervasive medium, much as water carried waves of kinetic energy and air carried sound waves. At the beginning of the 20th century, Einstein's work had suggested that there was in fact no theoretical necessity for the existence of such a medium. However, it took time for many scientists to abandon the idea of the ether, and radio engineers proved even more reluctant to let go. Indeed, during the 1920s and 1930s, the popularization of wireless technology helped keep the concept of the ether alive. This was at least in part because of the appeal of thinking about the new medium of radio in limitless, mystical, and almost supernatural terms. Early wireless experimenters could present themselves as voyagers in a strange realm, exploring its qualities and possibilities and using it to travel the world without physically moving. For some, such thinking shaded into a belief that the ether could even be used for psychical purposes, facilitating telepathy or telekinesis, or allowing the living to contact the dead. The latter was an especially beguiling possibility at a time when, in the wake of the First World War and the 1918 influenza pandemic, so many families had been left bereaved. The British physicist and inventor Sir Oliver Lodge, a pioneer and popularizer of the science of electromagnetism and radio waves, continued to promote the idea of the ether well into the interwar period, notably in his books Talks About Wireless and Ether and Reality, both published in 1925. He described the ether as the home of spiritual existence, the realm of the awe-inspiring and the supernal, the universal connecting link, the transmitter of every kind of force. Lodge had lost his own son in the war. A committed spiritualist, he believed that the ether could form a channel of communication with the deceased. More prosaically, many early wireless enthusiasts imagined themselves as inhabitants of the ether, a vast realm linking them with radio stations and with other amateur experimenters all around the world. Commercial radio manufacturers sought to profit from this conceit, marketing receiving sets with the promise that they would allow the consumer to master the ether. World Radio, a magazine published by the British Broadcasting Corporation, BBC, especially for distant listeners, included a Via Aether column each week, written by an aetherviator. This was, after all, the heroic age of the aviator, and containing information about transmissions from stations around the world. Crucially, the aether seemed to be a realm in which the national political and cultural differences of the physical world became almost irrelevant and might be overcome entirely. As one contemporary put it, fraternizing in the ether is the beginning of international understanding and world alliance. We might draw a parallel between all this and the ideas about the creation of an infinite, untrammeled cyberspace that developed at the end of the 20th century in the early stages of the digital revolution. The ether and cyberspace were both products of a futurist ethos that identified new forms of electric media with coming utopias, in which faster, fuller, and more readily accessible forms of communication would in turn create more perfect societies. There were also echoes of earlier thinking about the transformative and unifying effects of the late Victorian global network of telegraph lines that bound together continents and undersea cables that crossed the ocean floor. As Rudyard Kipling put it in what was probably one of the few poems to be inspired by the latter, "Hush, men talk today o'er the waste of the ultimate slime, and a new world runs between, whispering, let us be one." A key and recurring element in this rhetoric of the electrical sublime, applied to telegraphy, radio broadcasting, and later to the internet, was the idea that such communication might bring the world together in peaceful union. Yet the moment of the electrical sublime has always proved fleeting. By the time Strange was writing, the sense that the ether was a vast, untrammeled realm in which global harmony could readily be cultivated had already begun to seem outdated, even naive. Concerns about the number and power of broadcasting stations in operation and how they were starting to clash with one another had already led to some doubt that the ether really had limitless capacity. As the BBC's chief engineer wrote in 1925, "Continental stations had been springing up like mushrooms in the night, and it was not long before the overburdened ether began to squeak as two stations unknowingly rubbed shoulders to their mutual discomfort." The following year, the rapid proliferation of radio stations in Europe was cited as a reason to introduce binding international agreements on wavelength allocations, sharing out among the nations the finite frequencies available for broadcasting. The freedom of the ether could not be the unassailable right of every station. This would end in a chaotic free-for-all in which nobody would be able to listen to anything. Instead, it had to be regarded as the high privilege of all authorized transmitters operating within their prescribed limits. Stricter regulation was required. Subsequently, international wavelength allocation agreements temporarily reduced interference between different stations. However, these frameworks had to be continually revised as more and more powerful transmitters were built. In 1931, in World Radio, the Secretary General of the International Broadcasting Union, a body set up largely to devise and implement wavelength allocation agreements, dismissed the idea of an imminent war in the ether, waged using the powerful new transmitters being built by rival European powers, as sensational. However, a year later, another writer in the same magazine emphasized the danger posed by the aggressive use of broadcasting in Europe, the attempts on every side to poison the ether with national propaganda against that of the others. Rather than deploy the relatively short-lived interwar imagery of the ether, the chapters that follow encourage us to think in terms of a wireless world. This was an idea that recurred repeatedly in contemporary thinking about international broadcasting across the 20th century in many different countries. It often manifested itself in mundane form in the names given to radio magazines, including one of the premier British journals for wireless enthusiasts, The Wireless World, and radio receiving sets, and in the images used by wireless manufacturers and broadcasters to promote their wares or their services. In adopting the idea of a wireless world, the authors of this book have sought to avoid the simplistic vision of radio as a straightforward and benign globalizing force that is often associated with the utopian rhetoric of the electrical sublime. Instead of thinking in terms of an untrammeled, unstructured, and otherworldly ether, historians need to explore how human agency created a wireless world that came to reflect and propagate many of the imperfections and limitation of the physical world. The wireless world was, we argue in this book, shaped by institutions, power, hierarchies, inequalities, and perhaps most importantly, by the presence of nation-states, national language, national cultures, and empires. Crucially, the wireless world quickly became a densely populated and thickly entangled space, whose inhabitants competed and cooperated with and emulated one another. In exploring the idea of an entangled wireless world, historians of international broadcasting can draw on a rich body of work on connected history, or histoire croisée. This, in turn, has developed out of a wider field of global history, which has emphasized the importance of uneven, multidirectional flows of people, goods, money, and ideas in shaping and transforming the modern world. Such work has demonstrated that the history of transnational connectivity should not be viewed as a simple story of benign and progressive globalization. Rather, transnational connections reflected and often compounded existing global inequalities and frequently produced new forms of hierarchy. In terms of the wireless world, this is most apparent in the way that entangled international broadcasting initiatives reflected wider national and imperial policies of cultural projection and propaganda and were used to exert power in the global arena. Because not all states had access to equivalent resources and not all listeners enjoyed the same level of freedom to participate in the wireless world, inequality must be a central theme in any history of international broadcasting. Historians have already begun to write transnational entangled histories of broadcasting. The chapters that follow seek to distill, advance, and further develop this emerging agenda. They also introduce new perspectives from media history more generally, and from the history of technology, cultural history, and the study of soundscapes. The aim is to broaden our understanding of the history of international broadcasting and to make the topic relevant to a wider academic audience. This involves building on the insights of older studies which focused on the institutional histories of broadcasting organizations and on the relationships between those organizations and the national and imperial governments that often funded them and sought to influence their activities. It is crucial that we understand and continue to explore the role of states and their geopolitical agendas in shaping and directing the nature of international broadcasting services. However, we also need to move beyond purely institutional and political histories. The cultural impact of international broadcasting across the 20th century was enormous, yet it remains poorly understood. Historians of the wireless world need to pay more attention to programs, listeners, and soundscapes. We need to open our ears to the voices, music, and other noises that were carried by wireless over vast distances, and to seek to understand how people made distant listening part of their everyday lives. In rethinking the history of the wireless world, the chapters that follow also attempt to overcome the barrier to understanding posed by the traditional periodization of the subject. Too often, scholars have examined specific eras or decades, or even shorter periods, in isolation from their wider chronological context. Notably, international broadcasting during the Second World War has generally been treated as a topic in and of itself. Perhaps more damagingly, international radio during the Cold War has been examined in isolation and largely from the perspective of Cold War international history, making few connections with wider themes in media or cultural history. This book thus seeks to revise existing scholarship by placing the last 100 years of international broadcasting within a single analytic frame. This has involved exploring the 1920s and 1930s in more detail than is usual. Only recently have these decades attracted significant scrutiny from historians, and this new work is showing just how important the foundations established in this period were for subsequent developments. It has also involved factoring the history of decolonization more centrally into our understanding of the wireless world, further complicating our understanding of the Cold War era. Historians also need to make more of an effort to explore the history of international broadcasting after 1989, and especially the impact on the wireless world of the fall of communist regimes in the USSR and Eastern and Central Europe. Looking at how international broadcasters, their sponsors, and their listeners adapted to these profound geopolitical transformations and to the simultaneous dawning of a new digital age will help us further revise our understanding of key continuities and changes over the 20th and early 21st centuries. Creating the wireless world. During the 1890s, more or less simultaneously, scientists in a number of different countries conducted experiments with radio waves, using them to send signals over increasingly long distances. Initially, radio was seen as a means of point-to-point communication, conveying simple messages from one transmitter to a single receiver using Morse code dots and dashes. This practice was known as wireless telegraphy. During the early 20th century, it began to replace the old Victorian system of wired telegraph and cable networks and to play a particularly important role in facilitating maritime and ship-to-shore communication. Point-to-point wireless telegraphy continued to develop after the First World War as new long-range stations were constructed, generally using high-power long-wave transmitters. However, at the same time, amateur experimenters began to realize that shortwave frequencies could also be used to carry signals over very long distances. Previously, few had thought that wavelengths below 200 meters had much practical utility, but amateurs proved that shortwave signals could in fact cross the North American continent. In December 1921, when a test broadcast coordinated by the American Radio Relay League from New Jersey was picked up in Scotland and several other parts of the UK, experimenters also conclusively demonstrated that shortwaves could traverse the Atlantic. Crucially, shortwave transmitters required much less power to operate than did their longwave equivalents. The British Wireless Telegraph Station at Rugby consumed as much power as a small town. In contrast, the transmitter used in the 1921 shortwave experiment operated at a power rating of 50 watts, roughly the same as a light bulb. Two-way shortwave communication was soon established across the Atlantic, and in 1924, the first exchange of messages between Britain and New Zealand took place when Cecil Goyder, a pupil at Mill Hill School, North London, and a future chief engineer at All India Radio, made radio contact with Frank Bell, a farmer living in rural Otago. Ordinary people could, it seemed, use shortwave to travel vast distances through the ether with relatively inexpensive equipment. While these long-distance wireless telegraphy experiments were being conducted, regular and increasingly professional local and national wireless broadcasting services were also being established. Whereas wireless telegraphy was a point-to-point form of communication, wireless broadcasting was one to many. Contemporaries were quick to perceive the potential of broadcasting as a form of global mass communication. In part, this potential stemmed from the seemingly limitless nature of the ether. Radio signals could, it appeared, overcome all physical and man-made barriers and exert a universal reach. Moreover, unlike other technologies of mass communication, consumption by those receiving radio signals did not exhaust supply. All those within range of the transmitter who possessed a suitable receiver were able to enjoy access, whereas newspapers, magazines, or books needed to be printed in increased quantities to reach larger audiences. With radio broadcasting, the supply available to be picked up remained undiminished, no matter how many listened. Scarcity did not appear to be an issue. In the earliest days of radio, amateur and experimental broadcasters paid little attention to national borders. They simply sent out signals to be picked up by whoever wanted to listen, wherever they might be. Early wireless enthusiasts in the UK, for example, were just as likely to listen to a Dutch or French station as to a British one. Indeed, they were obliged to do so, as the experimental broadcasting stations of this period generally operated only for an hour or two each week. As broadcasting became established and institutionalized during the 1920s, stations proliferated, broadcast programs daily, and became more explicit in targeting local or national audiences. Nevertheless, their transmissions continued to reach listeners far beyond their intended service areas. On Europe's initially uncrowded airwaves, when atmospheric conditions were right, and especially at night, medium-wave signals could travel very far indeed. Early BBC broadcasts were picked up as far away as the Arctic and South Africa. Similarly, broadcasts from US stations were picked up across North, Central, and South America, and reportedly as far away as Cape Town in South Africa and Hobart, Australia. Although unusual, these were not freak occurrences. Extreme feats of distant listening were possible under favorable conditions, and bagging far-off stations became an obsession for some wireless enthusiasts. Dedicated hobbyists in the UK stayed up into the small hours to tune in low-power US stations, and American DXers sought out elusive European transmitters and discussed their triumphs and defeats with fellow distance killers. From the later 1920s onwards, national broadcasters built ever more powerful medium and long-wave transmitters, attempting to reach all possible listeners within their national borders. Interference between high-power transmitters located in different countries operating on the same frequencies created problems for some listeners. However, when international wavelength allocation plans worked, distant listeners could enjoy improved access to and clearer signals from a wide range of foreign stations. The BBC's Daventry longwave station became popular among listeners across Europe and beyond. It was later replaced by an even more powerful transmitter at Droitwich, as did the Deutsche Welle transmitter at Königs Wusterhausen near Berlin. Those in other countries who listened to such stations were generally considered to be eavesdroppers, picking up programs that were not intended for them. However, during the 1920s, some broadcasters began explicitly to target foreign listeners. Some of this work was done through exchanges and relays, as broadcasters cooperated with their counterparts in other countries and rebroadcast one another's programs using their own transmitters. Within Europe, exchange programs were relayed among stations and across national borders using medium and longwave transmitters, or, as new infrastructure was built, high-quality landline networks. Shortwave wireless beam transmitters were used to achieve relays over longer distances, notably across the Atlantic. Recorded programs, known as transcriptions, were also shared or sold internationally. Transcriptions, distributed on gramophone discs and later magnetic tape, offered a means to exchange non-topical material without using expensive and unreliable long-range transmitters and could be broadcast locally on accessible wavelengths at high fidelity. Increasingly, some broadcasters also began to provide regular, scheduled long-range services aimed at direct listeners in other countries. Sometimes the motives behind such initiatives were commercial. Radio Luxembourg offered the best example of a station set up to make money by broadcasting across borders. It was established in anticipation of a ban on commercial broadcasting in France. A powerful transmitter located in Luxembourg would be able to reach listeners in key French markets, circumventing government restrictions. However, once Radio Luxembourg began broadcasting in 1933, British listeners quickly became its most important audience, as British advertisers employed the station's services to circumvent the BBC's non-commercial monopoly of broadcasting in the UK. Meanwhile, some other international stations were operated by companies which hoped to use them to generate indirect profits. In the Netherlands, for example, the electronics company Philips established station PCJ to stimulate overseas sales of its radio receiving equipment. Yet the commercial possibilities of international broadcasting had their limits. Notably, although US stations were early adopters of shortwave technology, they could not make transatlantic radio services profitable. In what was still only a semi-globalized world economy, it remained difficult to sell consumer goods and thus advertising time in distant markets. International broadcasting was given a further boost by wider ideologies of internationalism. The idea that the nations of the world could be brought together in mutual peace and cooperation through conscious international, political, cultural, and economic initiatives arguably reached its apogee during the interwar years as a reaction to the horrors of the First World War. Many internationalists hoped that the new medium of radio, with its vast potential as a means of transnational mass communication, would promote a sense of mutual understanding among the nations, spreading knowledge and appreciation of different national cultures and perspectives on world affairs. The League of Nations' own broadcasting station, Radio Nations, was in many ways the clearest embodiment of this ideal, although the station's failings also reflected the wider limitations of interwar wireless internationalism. Religion provided another stimulus to international broadcasting. Widely regarded as the father of radio broadcasting, the British-based Italian inventor Guglielmo Marconi also played a key role in the establishment of Radio Vatican. Operated by the Society of Jesus and funded by the Vatican, the Italian fascist state and US private donors, the station was launched formally in 1931 as a global voice for the Catholic Church. It broadcast in an increasingly wide range of languages to reach the devout and spread faith around the wireless world. The nation-state in the wireless world. While radio sometimes appeared to be a limitless medium, in reality, international broadcasting depended on the expenditure of scarce and finite resources on an increasingly lavish scale. Whereas international broadcasting had initially been possible using relatively rudimentary equipment as broadcasters competed with and emulated one another, increasingly sophisticated and expensive operations became the norm. Broadcasters built more and more stations, each equipped with a growing number of transmitters, and each requiring eventual...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?